If you've been listening to Team Human, then you've heard about our sponsor, Groucho, the folks who find you people in your area to do dinners and salons with. Well, they've turned out to be not only a supporting sponsor of the show, but also a Team Human utility. That's right. So many Team Human people have been using the app to find others where they live that Groucho has ended up facilitating Team Human dinners in cities across the U.S. And there's people in a bunch of places looking for others to gather with. That's right. Team Human people in Alameda, Albany, Audubon, West Sussex, Brooklyn, Burlington, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Grayson, Hutchinson, Lafayette, Libertyville, London, L.A., Malvern, Medusa, Montreal, New York, Newcastle, San Diego, Owosso, Philadelphia, Portland, Prescott, Richmond, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, Sayo, Storrs, Toronto, Wichita. So if you're on Team Human in one of those places and looking to find the others, go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code TEAMHUMAN for half off the first month. And even if you're not looking for Team Human others, fill out the form and see who the curators find for you. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. Our guest today is Adam McKay, director of Don't Look Up, my favorite Adam McKay movie, The Big Short, Saturday Night Live, a bunch of Will Ferrell things, the first Succession, a member of the Upright Citizens Brigade, which is probably the most important credit anyone in any entertainment field can have. And we're delighted to have him with us. Adam, thanks so much for being on Team Human.
Thank you for having me. What I love about your writing and your ideas is that you're like actively grappling with this bizarre moment that we're in. And there's so many voices in the mainstream media that aren't, that are their incentives are so warped that they're trying to occlude the moment that we're in. But if you look at it, I think the most useful framework is that our country's been invaded. But like all great invasions, it involves new techniques. You know, you forget that all the great takeovers, empires, invasions, they always had some military or strategic innovation, whether it was the longbow or the Genghis Khan's horseback riders that could shoot with accuracy, or you go into Nazi Germany and using industrialization a step further than we have seen, and really catching a fatigued Europe off balance, using diplomacy as a smokescreen. And, once Citizens United happened, essentially the gates to the castle were open. And we still don't even know how many billions are coming through in dark money. I mean, we know Israel, probably Russia, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, but we have no idea because both of our political parties won't pass disclosure laws because they're making too much money and shorting stocks and, doing all this kind of stuff. But the big thing is, on top of this, we are literally living in a geological shift in eras, a planetary moment. And when you and I got in touch, I told you, I said, I have this theory that's burning a hole in my pocket.
And I know. And I'm honored that I'm the one you want to come to share it. So
yeah,
please.
Yeah. Like, You know, it used to be there would be public platforms for discourse, and Twitter, as messed up as it was, you could have conversations very early on. Facebook, without billionaire weirdos, you know, warping the algorithm, shutting you down. So there aren't a lot of places to have conversations where we actively think, kick around the idea. We know that university and college system has been semi-captured by big capital, which is heartbreaking. My oldest daughter is a grad student and describes to me like how careful you have to be. But anyway, I have this theory, and it centers around Dunbar's number, which, are you familiar? I'm guessing.
Yes.
Yes.
Most of the 120 people that anyone can really be reasonable friends with at one time, and that beyond that, our brains can't handle it.
Exactly. And this was observed in higher primates, and it really kind of held up to empirical observation that the uppermost limits of this number tended to be 150, and that was an outlier. Mostly it was what you said, which is around 120. So I stumbled upon this in someone's writing, I can't remember where, and I was like, well, why is that? Because we know that nothing in nature happens for no reason. Mm. There's a survival instinct behind it. It's the forces of the world forcing us to have opposable thumbs, and those that didn't died. And we know that evolution happens much faster than we think. It usually happens through quick die-offs. Mm. And so I started thinking about the idea of human beings, Homo sapiens, coming down from the trees. What was it? 2 million years ago? Something like that. And the savanna, the weeds that are growing are killing the trees, and these early hominids are up in the trees, and some of them start saying, we got to get down, and they get down, and then there's grass all around them, and some of them say, we got to stand up because we can't see the predators that are coming. And I'm sure centrist liberals and the New York Times op-ed section would have said, why standing up is a rash, disastrous maneuver. Ezra Klein would have talked about how this is not the move.
Right.
But some of these people did. And from that point on, you're in the interglacial period, or the Pliocene. And the Pliocene is characterized by undulating changes in climate. And glaciers are melting, freezing. But this is all happening over the course of 20,000 years, 50,000 years, 100,000 years. So we start to wander the globe because we're looking for food and stability. But what we're learning is it's not there. And so these little groups of hunter-gatherers are practicing, for lack of a better term, situational morality and ethics, which is, you and I are in a group. We've got 80 people. We have our wives that we love. We have our beautiful children. And we've gone into a valley that had, you know, weird pre-organized agricultural fruit, gnarled, you know, tart apples. But we're in heaven. We're eating them. Some of them are fermenting. So we're getting buzzed and drunk. We're laying around. We're, you know, probably singing early songs. And then, you know, clouds roll in, flash, floods, we got to move. And we move and we move and we move and we're starving. And then we come upon another group of hunter-gatherers and they look a little different than us. And we're like, let's kill them and and eat what they have. Better yet, let's eat them. And because my son's gonna die. And So you go through this period of Dunbar's number, which comes about as a way of diversification to guarantee survival of the species, smaller amounts. Some of them are going to get through, sort of like sperm making its way, towards the egg. And this is where for 500,000 years, we live in this state. They've looked at the fossil records. They've looked at the tree rings, the ice core, and it was all a period of unpredictable weather. There were no four seasons. You never knew what was going to happen because it was an interglacial period. And this is really who we are. These are the skills. Now, something miraculous happens. About 11,000 to 12,000 years ago, things start to relax. And you can see this in, you know, cave paintings. And so up until 11,000, 12,000 years ago, there is no organized agriculture. None. Even though we have all the tools to do it. Our frontal lobe is developed. We have opposable thumbs. We're seeing cave drawings, tools. There's no reason there shouldn't have been organized agriculture 50, 100, 200,000 years ago. But there was, as far as we know, which is pretty good, there wasn't. But then there's a crazy period where the weather gets insane, there's a big die-off, and Homo sapiens kind of band together and make it through. And then we enter the Holocene. And essentially, the Holocene is the period of the four seasons. Cue Vivaldi, cue farmers reaping crops. And for a couple of thousands of years, you can tell people are like, don't quite get it. And there's still, it's kingdoms, it's invasion. But then they start to get it, and you start to see astrological structures. You start to see like harvest, you know, hieroglyphs. And boom, we have organized agriculture. And with this, we start to break Dunbar's number because the advantages to the survival of the species are so huge. If we can go beyond 120, 150 and work together, we now know in 3 months, it's going to get colder. In 3 months past that, it's going to get really cold. But then in 3 months, it's going to get warmer. And then in 3 months, it's going to get warmer. So if you think of like Joseph saying like, hey, there's famine coming up. I mean, I'm sure there were people at that time that were like, oh, there's four seasons, and they were treated like prophets and like, you know, soothsayers. And so right around the time where everyone starts to get that there are four seasons, you start to see the early beginnings of modern religion. I mean, in some regards, Abrahamic religion, but then Buddhism is a part of it. And all of that, whether you're talking Muhammad, Jesus, Buddha, all can be boiled down to take a deep breath and effing relax. Like, everyone was so in Dunbar's number that we're going to be attacked. We have to get that, you know, in the case of Siddhartha, this super rich guy goes out, sees the poverty, and is like, what the hell? We don't have to have this. And his message is basically take a long, deep breath and realize that we're no longer in that 1 million to 2 million year period of total unpredictability. Interesting side story to that. Some of the early Buddhists went up to northern China and were trying to teach them about Buddhism, breathing, you know, peace, connection with the land. But northern China was so warlike and everyone was fighting that they couldn't hear it. So the Buddhists were like, we have to combine the breathing with the fighting, and you have Shaolin Kung Fu resulted. Right. So the only way they could get their attention was, this will help you fight better. And they were like, cool. Anyway, so we go through this period, and that begins the basically the history of civilization.
Right. The Axial Age. Yeah.
Yeah. You hear people say prehistoric. Now we're in the historical age because there are four seasons. We can write stuff down. Flash floods won't tear them away. And or tornadoes or hurricanes. And essentially, the entire story of civilization is a battle between Dunbar's number and breaking the ceiling of Dunbar's number. And this new religion where we turn the other cheek, honor killings. Honor killings were a huge problem for thousands of years. And so, you know, there's a reason that Jesus and the prophets of his time are saying turn the other cheek, because they're seeing how much it's dividing people, destroying quality of life. And essentially, you look at the whole history of civilization is a devil and angel on the shoulder, with the angel representing the Holocene and the devil representing the Pliocene or the interglacial period. So to land on this, and then I'm dying to hear what you think.
Yeah.
I look at the moment we're in as we are empirically, without a doubt, outside of the Holocene. The Holocene has ended. We are roughly at 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial. And we know with this El Nino that's going to hit, we're probably going to jump up to 1.7 degrees Celsius. And then at that point, I mean, short of geoengineering, we're going to hit 2C.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, call it 2. Gimme. It's a gimme. Yeah.
Yeah. So at 2.3C, organized agriculture collapses. So we are these upright monkeys that are walking around with this vast subconscious DNA level history. We are mostly pre-holocenic creatures. Now the very climate that we live in is no longer in the Holocene. And so there are many cause and effects to the moment we're in. But I would say, I think we can all agree, at best, we know about 20% of what's actually going on right now. And that 80% is subconscious, DNA level, just muscular, a chemical reaction, swirling, you know, planted in the Goldilocks zone behavior. And it's no accident that the elites were the first ones to go to Pliocene, hunter-gatherer, situational behavior first, because that's always been the story. The workers and the people that support this system, first and foremost, you had to get them in line. And then it's always been touch and go with the, you know, pedophilic, incestuous, weirdo elites when the people exert their influence and say, no, we have incredible periods like post-World War II America in the, I would say, late 70s, where the first creation of a middle class happens and you get an explosion in great literature. And by the way, not a perfect time. There's the slaughter in Vietnam, but that's entirely driven by CEOs and elite government. So my final sort of theory that I bring to you is that this is all about Dunbar's number.
In some ways, yeah. There's history's parallel to the one that you recounted. At the axial age moment that you're talking about, when we went from tribes to towns, cities, and civilization, there were we in the Israeli, Greek, you know, thing. There were others who did other things and had alternative strategies. And there are some examples of larger, what could be considered larger civilizations that didn't go that sort of agricultural property pyramidal route. But again, most of those are more like confederations than they are a single thing.
Yeah. Are you talking about the one in Turkey? The one they discovered that was like larger pre-Holocene. Yeah. But that, I mean, there are little flare-ups.
There's examples. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm saying, and ours is certainly the one that ended up growing and dominating, the one that we're all in. But there are some things, you know, and looking at the Confederation of American Tribes and how they went. But what you're talking about is, in some sense, is what Torah is about. It's how do we go from being Dunbar Bedouin tribes to this big thing down in Mitzrayim, in the narrow place. And they actually saw it as, I mean, in some cases it was actual, but it was also mental slavery to become part of one of these pyramidal civilizations. Because once you become that big, the organizers of it are no longer tribal chieftains of 120 people. Now they're moving up a pyramid where they're trying to accumulate wealth and store things. And even Joseph goes, that little sellout, even Joseph goes and says, look, 7 years of feast. Why don't you gather the stuff, keep it all? Because when it changes, you're going to be able to lend it. You're going to be able, when they don't have money, you're going to get some slaves. It's going to be great. You know, and it's his own people he's sold in. But it's sort of revenge on the brothers, I guess. And then it's, come on down, the water's fine. You know, and he invites Jacob and everyone. And then, you know, 400 years later, they're really shit out of luck without a paddle, whatever. But no, I do see that. And the, not to play noble savage with them, but when 120 Dunbar group found another one, there's a lot of evidence that rather than fighting, they exchanged children.
Situational, though. Yeah. Always situational.
Right.
Always Malthusian. I was shocked when I started reading, you know, anthropologists, paleontologists, how definitive they were about no organized agriculture, even though we had all the tools for it till 11,500 years ago. You know, it's a great example.
I didn't think I'd like getting sponsors for Team Human, but turns out the ones who actually want to sponsor us totally get what we're about. Like Groucho, which uses technology as an antidote to social isolation, handling all the logistics for twice monthly gatherings between you and a hand-curated cohort of collaborators. It's as if Groucho were informed by the ideas we share on this show, from face-to-face interaction to bottom-up community to localism to the value of eccentricity over conformity. Groucho curates people as if they were being selected for an artist's colony, not clones, but complements and contrasts, ingredients for a collaborative stew. They also take care of all the logistics from dinner reservations to conversation starters. Just go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for half off the first month. Answer some questions about yourself in your own time and let the humans at Groucho do the rest. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code teamhuman for half off the first month and enjoy your dinner and new friends.
The city of Tehran. Do you know how old the city of Tehran is? 11,000 years old. And forget the war that's going on. They're going to have to evacuate Tehran because they're out of water. I mean, we see the headlines of lunatic Trump and Netanyahu bombing them using ceasefire talk. And I was shocked when I found out how definitive that number was. Like, you are correct. Like, there's that place in Turkey, but it shows a larger scale, but it seems like it was more of a, you know, aberration where it was an area where the weather wasn't as violent
for a period. When things are okay, people seem to be able to tolerate larger than 120 groups.
Totally.
You know, that does happen. It's certainly down, you know, in the Amazon and in South, we see examples of it, but I get what you're saying there. And I've been generally one on the side of it was easier for humans to be pro-social in their smaller groups than it is when they're in one way or another indentured or enslaved in a pyramidal civilization like ours. We tried in the 19th and 20th century to look at how do we combat that, and I come from a line of leftists. You know, my grandmother marched with Eugene Debs and sang Stalinistic songs. You know, she was a good, you know, workman's circle, Jew, Catskill, New American. And I empathize with that until now. I see Nothing. I like unions and all, but I see unions as in some ways reifying the corporate state that we're in. In other words, we accept that we're under corporate control, so we better band together and have unions to fight against it rather than reorganizing our society around something else.
I mean, I'm obviously hugely pro-union,
yeah, guild,
but I see what you're saying in that the unions and guilds are still a byproduct of the corporate capitalistic endeavor.
Right.
I mean, what I've really learned in the past 5 to 10 years is that I am clearly a socialist, and you know, it used to be a joke with Rosa Luxemburg's socialism or barbarism, but it may be the most important truism in the history of mankind.
Yeah, yeah. The opposite of socialism is Margaret Thatcher saying there is no society. So that's what I wanted to do a book. I wanted to call it, you know, putting the social back into socialism.
Ah,
it's like
lose the
ism. It's like the isms are always about Judaism. It's like once it's an ism, you're fucked, right? You know, it's locked down. But once it's just, you know, social, that sounds fine to me. Do you want to be social? Yeah, let's be social. So let's meet your neighbors, share shit with them.
What's crazy is you hear socialism and you immediately think of a college class or a book you have to read. It's really easy.
Yeah.
It's like tax the rich, including me, nationalize key industries, nationalize healthcare, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, but you can do it from the bottom up as well, which is what I argue, you know, meet your neighbor, borrow a drill, you know, rather than buying your own.
All right, I'm going to introduce a new lane to to my theory about Dunbar's number. All of marketing and advertising is predicated on speaking to our pre-Holocene brain, whether it's Edward Bernays, whether, you know, he took it from Freud. We have this elaborate keyboard inside our heads, and it's ugly and dark, but it's also funny, is like anti-immigration sentiment. So I read an interview with an ultra-nationalist right-winger from Poland. And it's important to know that Poland actually really has no immigration, that more Polish people leave to go be immigrants, but yet their right-wing nationalistic party, which is gaining a lot of power, is built on, we got to stop the immigrants. So the journalist said to one of the leaders, you know, you statistically, for all intents and purposes, have no immigrants. And the guy just went, and moved on. And the whole anti-immigrant thing is off of hunter, gatherer, Dunbar number groups confronting hardship and going over a horizon line and meeting people with different hair, different jewelry, and being like, are they cannibals?
Right. And good luck as a Marxist using facts on the ground and statistics and logic to counteract that such primal, almost reptilian impulse, which is why, this is what I've been arguing, and I think you do this with comedy, with humor, with art. The only path we have is we have to look like we're having more fun than they are, right? We got to be having a party with AOC and Bernie and a barbecue and sex and rave. We are the ones who are having a good time. And the friggin' fascist, anti anti-whatever, anti-immigration sloth are the ones who are having the bad time.
I'm totally with you. The great thing about the left and socialism is we laugh, we have sex, we barbecue, we love sports. I suck at basketball, but yet I love basketball. And we are way more fun than corporate centrists and the extreme right.
Right.
Not the center right. They could be kind of fun too.
No, originally I avoided being yuppie scum, half because I didn't want to sell out, but half because I didn't want to be a friggin' cloned loser, conformist, horrible person.
They're so boring. I always say they have like centrist liberals. The only difference between them and Mitt Romney is they have better playlists. That's it.
Oh, and again, you get in trouble for saying this, and you say worse things than I can. So you've moved the Overton window. But as an aside, I will tell you, Obama admitted that he was closer to Reagan than to a progressive. Bill Clinton was Reagan, but Bill
totally.
Clinton, and in some ways, it had a more substantial Reaganite a political agenda than Reagan himself.
Ding, ding, ding.
And we wonder why we needed to do Occupy.
Well, I mean, if you look at Bill Clinton, and I totally agree, his six major changes that he made, if you look at them on paper, you can't tell the difference between right. Reagan
Carceral
and Clinton.
State, welfare reform.
justice reform. Glass-Steagall. I mean, on and
yeah.
on. Deregulating the media, which destroyed news. But what did Bill Clinton have that Reagan didn't have? He had marketing for a target group.
Right.
And one of my favorite pre-Holocene buttons that you see pushed on privileged liberals, corporate liberals, is always the, we're the grown-ups, we have to make compromises. And never mind that those compromises preserve your individual privilege. It's really pushing a button from 100,000 years ago where you were like, we got to leave grandpa.
Right, right.
The flash
right.
floods are coming. And
exactly.
by the way, you probably did have to leave grandpa.
Yeah, the Eek people. Remember them? We had to read that in middle school. They used to leave the old people up on the hill. It's like, you're too old to take care of. Go die. You know, and luckily we're not so much in such a civilization like that. Now we have, well, we're getting there.
Well, we are empirically, scientifically,
right.
we have exited the Holocene.
Right, right.
And
so let's go to that.
Please.
So let's go back to your Dunbar here. So where I very much empathize with this is people sense they are, especially through social media and the number of contacts we have and the number of incoming texts and all these things, that we are no longer in our Dunbar, that we've been thrust into civilization, meaning that thing of foreigners and Jews and city people, all those forces that want us to be part of something bigger than ourselves and not in our little tribal thing. The people who tell us our gods. I mean, it's not that the Jews killed Christ. It's the Jews kill Christ every single day they don't believe in him, right? Every single day they deny his thing. So I get that. So it's like our Dunbar tribal thing, even if I've never had one, even if I can't remember one except, you know, through junk DNA memory, right, in my core.
No. You brushed past that too quickly. And I think that moment where you said Dunbar's number, junk
yeah.
DNA, that's the gateway towards I am now susceptible to...
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Even if I can't place it, even if I don't consciously remember it's sitting there in my somatic memory, and it gets triggered if my hatred of immigrants could be as easily triggered by having too many people on social media as too many Mexicans in my city or too many television channels to watch.
That's good.
I'm in a state of overload, so I want to reduce, cut the border. So somehow building a wall from Mexico somehow shuts out all the stuff, right?
So good. Oh, it's so good. I mean, I always joke about the history of walls because it's not a great history. And any time you have a history that has failed over and over and over, that means you repeat it. It's psychological. It's subconscious. And the Great Wall of China was cool for 100 years and then utterly failed. The wall from Pink Floyd did not work. Got where Sid Barrett / the rest
but
of Pink
I would Book. Look at the I would
Fenway
look at the height,
Park Fenway
but the,
Park
the height of the Holocene the height of the Holocene is television, because television was the global media, right? Television held us together. It created global markets. It created the simultaneous moment of watching a moon landing or watching the Olympics. Television was everybody. And the height of television politics was Ronald Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate saying, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," right? Television peaked. And now, in the age of the post-Holocene, of the beginning of the internet, what do you get? Donald Trump building walls. Their walls are back.
So I love your point that television, almost because of its technical limitations from, late 30s through the 70s, 80s, pre-cable, before
Pre-Turner,
launched that satellite that created cable. But before that, you have this combination of post-World War II, almost for lack of a better term, like civic duty, where World War II did a big thing, which is even the mafia got in line behind World War II. Even though the people that represented the elites, the Republicans, fought it early on, once it got going, they were in line. And that kind of spirit of we're all in this together, it wasn't perfect. I mean, it took Walter Cronkite 5 years longer than it should have to say the Vietnam War is insane. But still, because there were four channels, there were the three networks, PBS, and then the weird UHF dial
that for I Lucha would watch. Libre. Yeah.
And I think it's hard for people to comprehend when the series finale of MASH hit. I mean, MASH had a vibe to it. MASH's vibe was like, we are humans. We are compassionate. We are funny. We are flawed. And this slaughter is going by us, this MacArthur insane, Korean War slaughter, but we are beautiful people. And when that series finale hit, that feeling radiated across the country. Mm. And then you're totally correct. It went to a paid extreme right-wing actors saying, tear down this wall, who shot JR, the Super Bowl, and we were you know, in the
and we're off to the races.
Yeah.
And even you can look at media, I mean, the implicit media Dunbar numbers. At least if you could only watch one network a night, you still knew, okay, Dynasty's going on that other channel and some other thing, but I'm going to sit and watch Happy Days. You know, you at least, you knew what else was in the neighborhood that night. Now there's just no, where it's fractured, you know, so even our information is just, we're on an overwhelm, you know. So I would agree. We are yearning for, and even the super elite are yearning for something more Mad Max than you know, as if, because that's the only post Holocene they can imagine. You know,
yeah.
they can't imagine a some kind of soft landing, some kind of a thing. I mean, what I've been trying to figure out is sort of, if Torah narrative is true, where are we in the story? Are we about to go into Egypt, or are we trying to come out? You know?
That is good. All right. So I had this thought the other day, which is, where are the biblical end timesers? Because my whole life, they've been loud, throw it, and they're quiet. And I started thinking, like the El Nino that we're looking at, which the name El Nino comes from the people of that region, the Central Eastern Pacific, noticed that every 2, 3, 4, 5 years, there would be this crazy warming of the ocean that would basically coincide with Christmas. So El Nino is the child. And it was like, where are my lunatic end timers saying, like, this is the second coming of Christ? Because there are legitimately people that are concerned we cannot withstand what's coming from this El Nino. It's right now looking like it's going to be probably 3C, potentially 3.5C, and maybe 4C. And in Fahrenheit terms, that's 7 degrees right. Fahrenheit warming in the... And that will, as we know from the last El Nino, these El Ninos are now serving as global temperature bumps. So if it bumps us to 1.7, the last El Nino bumped us from 1.3 to roughly 1.5, and it never went back.
Right. That's the thing. They don't go back.
The El Ninos. So when you talk the Torah to me, by the way, my whole family is Jewish, speaks Hebrew. We were supposed to go to Israel before, you know, all the ugliness started. So
you would have been back in the 40s, right?
Yeah. I was married and I stepped on the glass. I mean, it's Irish.
Listen, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, the idea, the Torah to me is the work to look at, because the Torah covers pre-Holocene.
Right. And it's looking at, how do we develop an ethical template to live in the Holocene era, in a print era, in an era with contracts and history and ownership and property and farming. You know, that's what it was for. But then it also teaches, how do you make a transition? How do you, you know, that's what I was looking at before. So how do we make the next transition? So then I wrote that book, 10 Commands for a Digital Age, looking at commands instead of commandments and all that. But yeah, a lot of good that did. But I really don't know how. So lately, what I've done is shifted from sort of strategizing what to do to this sort of palliative care. You know, I've kind of moved more toward doula energy. How do I help this society create the emotional capacity? I start reading people like Spinoza, who are looking at, what they talk about is that what we've got to train is the human capacity to affect and be affected by others, you know, which is It goes back to Dunbar in a way.
Yeah.
How do you metabolize this moment together?
The shift you're talking about is exactly where I am, where a lot of climate activists, scientists, thinkers are. We have exited the first window. The first window we made, Don't Look Up, when was it released? Like 2021. And Sir David King, who's a big fancy chemist in the UK, had said, we have 4 to 5 years for serious action. So my hair was on fire. And I had spoken to other scientists and done the whole tour. We have exited that window. It's over. We're not net zero by 2050. Tax breaks for
there's no Al Gore venture capital fund you can invest in to fix it.
So now we're in the brace yourself period. And part of the brace yourself period is the Hail Mary, Fran Tarkington to, what was that receiver? I can't remember his name. The Hail Mary phase. And the Hail Mary phase is really simple. It's geoengineering and carbon removal. And if we had sane, functioning Western governments and news media, this would be all we are talking about. Because without a World War II level mobilization, change of footing, culture and direction, we will not be able to successfully geoengineer and carbon remove at that scale. And there are like 30 other things, like silly things that can make a difference, like paint your roof white, paint the streets white, create like Dune, the movie, the book, Dune style water storage, convert the military, the U.S.'s military is, it's like Jabba the Hutt. It's so fat.
Right. And all that, though, all that is predicated on large government national structures functioning, and
post
then I think about
Dunbar number.
Right. And because I keep thinking about, and I've got lots of, whatever we call meta crisis friends who talk about, oh, it wouldn't be so bad if we move back to kibbutz stage, with all these little groups. And it's like, yeah, but then who's going to be cooling the fuel rods at the nuclear reactor that's no longer on? It's like you need a big society to do that kind of shit.
I mean, that is the perfect exchange to describe where we're at, because I'm hearing a lot of people talk the way they don't. We're going to go back to decentral. We're going to go back to pre-Dunbar number. Like, the floods that hit and hurricanes that hit Florida. I can't even remember the name of the hurricane that went through central Florida like 3 years ago, just destroyed central Florida. The one community that kind of survived was like an ex-NFL player and a real estate developer created a climate resilient community in central Florida.
They work. They've got Tamera in Portugal, and they use the water and circulate the things and change the weather system. It does work. It's just, there's a lot of people.
The nuclear fuel rods.
Right. Right. Good. People say, oh, we'll turn off the nuclear power plants. You can't just turn them off.
No, you cannot. No.
You could stop taking energy from them, but they're sitting there. So it's like, you got better get Bezos to shoot them into space fast.
Right. And the climate droughts, lower the rivers that they're on so much that they've had to occasionally shut down the nuclear reactors because they have the water levels in the, like, you know, it was in France, I think, and they had to, like, shut down the nuclear reactors. Well,
they're taking the water for the data centers anyway. So that's a couple of fuel rods blow up, whatever.
We're going to get more,
get more AI going. But the other thing is the for all the predictive analysis we do, and the movie was great. Don't Look Up was great for that. For all the predictive analysis we do, other shit happens. It's like the ocean thing, the under the under ocean current that's supposed to be
the
going up.
AMOC.
Yeah, it's slowing down to nothing. Yeah. That's a reverse. Buffalo will no longer be whatever the super city that you think. You know, all the predictions, all the people buying real estate in Winnipeg and Siberia, thinking that those are the places. Just watch. It's going to be some poor people in Madagascar that are suddenly in the perfect climate. You know?
Do you know what they recently discovered? Woolly mammoths, you know, from the Younger Dryas and the Pliocene, the last area they survived were up around the Aleutian Islands, the land bridge. That could end up becoming the rallying point for human civilization.
You heard it here first. You can get your real estate at rushkov.realestate.com /illusion for 15% off commissions. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
What a pleasure, man. And this is fun. This is exactly what I was looking for, which is idea, theory, feedback, kick it around. And it's, you know, my wife and I have been watching old Dick Cavett interviews with, like, Orson Welles, Muhammad Ali, you know, Malcolm X. And you're like,
Norman Mailer. I mean, he had such people on there.
And he's great because the people say things that, like, you would get canceled on the internet, you would get, and he hears them out, and then he comes back, and he challenges them, and it's very relaxed. It's very Hollis-y. He knows there are crops being harvested. There are factories. There are international peace treaties, and he's very relaxed and thoughtful.
It's different. It's funny. I know a guy who was tripping with turtles for, like, weeks and weeks, just taking acid, hanging out with turtles.
Come on.
And he said, yeah. And at the very end, he said, the turtle looked at him, and he could feel it saying to him, you know, after all this time watching the human, just saying, looking up and saying to him, slow the fuck down.
So true. Yeah.
Because we're in this frantic thing to stop, breathe. Because the thing I've been trying to show people too, not that it's as good as putting, you know, white on our roofs, but if people would consume so much less if they just hung out and enjoyed each other more. If there wasn't that desperation, meet your neighbors. You don't have to get in the car, hang out, learn to have sex. It's like very energy efficient form of entertainment, even better than playing a CD. You know, it's all easy.
I came up through an incredible scene, which was I was in Philadelphia. I was in college. I was doing stand-up during the original stand-up boom in the 80s. I was all right. I wasn't great. And I was like, this isn't it. And I had a friend. This is pre-internet. So the only way I can learn about this is a buddy of mine goes to Chicago, comes back, and says there's an incredible thing going on in Chicago. And I'm like, what? And he's like, it's improvisation. And I'm like, oh, you mean those silly little games? He's like, no, they're improvising plays under this guy, Del Close, who's been around forever, actor, director, worked with Elaine May. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. And once again, going back to what you said, there's no text. There's no internet. So my buddy, Rick, Roman, and I, for like a day and a half, we have like, I'm in Philly. We have beers at this local bar. We're sitting around and he's describing to me what this scene is. And my mind is blown. I'm like, wait a minute. They get crowds for this? He was like, oh yeah, it's packed. And I'm in my senior year of college at Temple University. And I'm like, I'm done. I drop out. I sell the only valuable thing that I have, which is my old comic book collection from when I was a kid, actually got a good price. I got $1,000 in 1989, and right. I buy a shag carpeted Chrysler New Yorker, and we go to Chicago, and I walk into this theater, and it was co-founded by an old socialist activist theater guy, David Shepard, with Sharna Halpern, called the IO Theater. And my friend told the truth. There's 140 people jammed in this little theater, and there's a group on stage just making it up. And it's the most electric thing I have ever seen. And that led to us creating the Upright Citizens Brigade. I did Second City, got hired by SNL. But the point of me bringing this up is Second City, legendary theater, bought by private equity, Upright Citizens Brigade, which I haven't been a part owner of for a long time, bought by a financial consortium. IO shut down, reopened, and this is actually the best of the cases I've heard, kind of billionaire Chicago real estate guys. Nothing is more communal. Nothing is more Holocene than long-form improvisation. You're on stage. It almost becomes like Del Close, who was a, you know, pagan witch, would say, you know, I apologize. This almost gets Christian in its nature when he would teach you private equity, conglomerates, like,
people laughing is money signs, you know, that's, but it's still around. You go see, what's his name at Largo. You're in LA, right?
Yeah.
It's still, there's still, people are doing it.
By the way, it's a big world. I mean, when I was 21 in college in Philly, for me, because you could have cheap rent, you could get a crappy job, you could sleep on couches to be creative. Now, if I were looking at it and I were 21 or 22 or whatever, I would probably be looking at other countries. I would probably be looking at like Barcelona, Dublin. There's, what is it, Leipzig in Germany, I've heard is really cool. Buenos Aires, even though the country is a train wreck, that city is very creative.
I was just in São Paulo, which is, you know, poor city. It's as poor as it gets, but my God, are they brilliant and alive and social on a level that I hadn't. I hadn't seen in 20 years.
What do you think? Question for you. Should we just shut down our social media? I mean, I struggle with it. I'm no longer on Twitter because he became such an overt Nazi.
I went off it for I went off it in 2013 because it was just like blah, and I felt what it was doing. And now, and I feel guilty about it, but I'll feel guilty about something, whoever, whatever I do. My podcast, we use it to post, here's a new episode and all.
Yeah, of course.
But I figure it's like going into the den of thieves and offering a Bible.
I have
right?
no judgment. I have no, like, I was on it. And by the way, you could argue Zuckerberg is in a way more of a Nazi than Musk, because he just hides it. So Instagram is terrible. They're all owned by extreme right wing super villains.
Right. I don't care about the way they steal our data, if only because it's already being stolen. They know there's the camera in your TV is taking pictures of the screen and sending it to people. It's like, you know, every 7 seconds, some of these brands of TVs are sending it back. It's like, that's gone. It's I'm less concerned with the sort of the Palantir surveillance than the Oracle Larry Ellison media creation based on your profile. It's more the programming. You know, when you were talking of before, I was thinking about the human nervous system being hacked, you know, how easy we are to be hacked. We're just a human consciousness is sitting in this little dark place using eyes to try to get some frequencies, ears to hear some frequencies, and a little bit of touch. And those senses are being hacked on a level. The lizard, the pre-Holocene is being spoken to by not even by people concocting things, but now by algorithms and artificial intelligences concocting ways of doing it, so that we are being brought intentionally decalibrated and controlled in a way that I think that the only solution to that is disconnection from those systems and reconnection with two other eyeballs.
I agree. I think it's gotta go to the level of, I mean, I'm having a Cold War, pleasant, polite argument with my wife and daughters about one of the major streaming platforms that has very morally onerous, creepy, you know, practices. And they're like, yeah, but we'd like to. I don't like, at some point, you have to like to use a matrix, you know, analogy. You've got to rip the umbilical. I mean, we've got to feel consumer pain.
Right. Because what people don't realize is the content. Let's just take Paramount as one example. The content on the platform supports the ethos of the business model of the platform. That's what these characters are doing. Everyone from the city who cares about the climate is a friggin' idiot, who's compromised on some level. And it's everything is so more tilted than any Norman Lear comedy ever was. You know, you go back and look at that, and people think this is all a reaction to liberal media of Norman Lear. Norman Lear made a bigot like Archie Bunker lovable and human.
Totally. Totally. So people love to look, or Penske Media, who owns the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, love to dig through when I do conversations like this.
Oh, I saw that. Oh, my God. It got covered everywhere because you blamed, you basically said the liberals are responsible for the collapse of liberalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Duh.
And so they've done this to me like nine times. I no longer care. If anything, I'm kind of thankful, because I'm like, anyone who's believing that, I probably shouldn't associate with.
Right.
Anyway, but here's the part they can dig out and turn into a distorted headline. When the show Friends came on TV, I had the worst feeling, because let me be really clear. The people, the actors on that show are incredibly talented. The writing staff on that show, one of the best writing staffs ever. The reason they're so good is the show has no relation to the real physical world, yet it's able to approximate the feelings of living. And I had five friends say, you have to watch it. It's so good. And I watched it. And I was like, that's scary. The idea that you can make a work, whatever, TV show, play, song, that pretends the real world doesn't exist and yet looks like the real world. I would also say Seinfeld, but Seinfeld was more of a misunderstanding because Larry Charles thought he was depicting vile, petty people,
right?
Which is why he did that end episode.
Right. He could punish them.
But in the case of Friends, I was like right away, like network TV is done.
And you compare it with, say, Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners, which may as well be a play by Clifford Odets. You know, he's this working class man. Every episode, we're going to get out of here. We're going to make it.
So
capitalism's going to succeed. And he's let down. And his wife has to forgive him for, you know, selling the family farm again. It was, yes, you're still in one little room, but the outside world was ever present on him. And television reversed itself now. So there's no outside world at all.
Or look at Good Times. So we had a deal years ago with one of the big networks, and I naively was like, what are they doing? Like, they could be doing good shows. So I pitched them an idea, Red State, Blue State. And the premise was a professor of semiotics at University of Massachusetts. They eliminate his department because they're like, no one cares.
Right.
And his wife is like, my brother has that auto parts chain Alabama. And so they got to move down south. And we had cast Dave Koechner, and we had a really good woman playing his wife. And it was essentially the most sort of liberal intellectual example of a character with the most money kind of right winger. And the whole show was making fun of both, finding connections. I actually wrote the script and it was good. I mean, I've written a lot of scripts and I can tell you some are not so good. Some are good. Some you get really excited about. And this was definitely good to almost really excited. They didn't even call us to tell us that they had passed on it. It was, and I started realizing like, oh, the advertisers, which dictate network TV, like a casino pumping in fresh oxygen and not having clocks, they probably learned through the decades that consumers not exposed to the reality of the world they live in are better consumers. And then I started getting curious. So I would start to ask the executives, I'd be like, so what do you want? And I had some of the funniest conversations where they wouldn't tell me. And I was like, yeah, but what's your dream show? Is it Friends? Or, and it was clear that it was just, it's an industry run by advertisers. But yeah, what's scary about it is that is now the culture we live in. I mean, if you look at the movies, I mean, not all of it, but 85% of it, streamers, network, movies, is can you give us a story that has no relation to the world, yet feels like it does?
Right.
And you will make a ton of money.
Right. We want verisimilitude, but with complete complete abstraction from the ground. Yeah.
So the story of us talking becomes you're a cool Manhattan writer, professor. I'm a disillusioned Hollywood writer, director. And in a way, the two of us are going to invigorate each other by our arguments and what results. And never will we deal with inequality, poverty, climate, the Gaza. Oligarchy. It's right. Mostly me saying, dude, you got to give your hair a little spike.
Oh, I'll do that. I'll do that. But you know what I will tell you? It is interesting because I feel like the knowing you as a human now, which I feel I do, there's you have the quality of that the I'm sure people talk to you about it a lot, but the last scene in Don't Look Up, when not the one where they get eaten by the things, which is great. You have that too.
The Bronterux. Yeah.
When they're holding hands around the table. Because that to me, you know, I saw a lot of myself in that movie. Not that you ripped me off in that way, but I saw a lot of the way I think and my ideas about the future and the way that the scam artist, scientist, the whole thing and the transhuman nonsense and our inability to see. But to me, the team human moment of that, and I don't know if I was supposed to, I cried in the theater at it.
Oh, yeah.
Was when they're holding hands around the table and they decide that this. You know, the moment is infinity. The moment is all we have. It's the orchestra playing on the deck of the Titanic as it goes down. You know, I was doing a talk and someone as a critique said, sounds like you sounds like you're in the orchestra on the deck of the Titanic as it's going down. And I thought for a second and I was like, what more beautiful thing could you have possibly said to me?
Yeah.
What more holy, sacred value can a human being have?
So let me tell you this story, which I've told a couple of times before, but never in this context. So the line I wrote, I mean, the whole movie was about that dinner scene. I mean, that's what I was experiencing. I was like, I'm in a farcical, over-the-top comedy that is going to end in like a pawnbroker, like dark, heartbreaking tragedy.
The world ends. I mean, so people, not to spoiler alert, but you know, it's a friggin' comet hits the Earth, and Jennifer Lawrence and the other people who are the people taking us through the story end up just deciding to eat a regular meal together. As the thing hits, to be normal and hold hands and be together.
So the line for me when I was writing the script was Jen Lawrence saying, at least we tried. And I remember writing that and like, I like a lot of emotions. And the beauty of theater filmmaking is it's collaborative. So DiCaprio is really smart and really emotionally attuned to what he's doing. And when he chose to do a movie with the guy who directed Step Brothers, he knew what he was doing and he liked the script. We met. He saw he understood that I got what we are facing. And on the night we were shooting it, he kept saying to me, I feel like there's one more line there. And I was like, at least we tried is my line. That's how I feel. And he kept saying, there's something missing. And he came up to me and my script supervisor, who, by the way, you would love, Kate Hardman. We call her the Texas Rattlesnake. Super funny, cool, smart artist. And he said, what about this? And he's like, Jen Lawrence says, at least we tried. There's another line. And then he takes a beat and he goes, and he says, I'll stumble on it. And I'll say, wow, we really did have everything, didn't we? And instantly, Kate and I started to cry. And I was like, yeah, that's the line. And we shot the movie during COVID. So I had to use the microphone. And very first take, I said, Leo's going to have a line. And he said the line in front of the actors. And after I yelled cut, they were all like, oh. Like, yeah, it's funny. You know, we all scurry around. We do our things. We try and cover our bases. But it goes back to the theme of our talk that at our best and most powerful, we are connected to lots of people. We are open to responses, emotional responses. And that moment where Leo was like, wow, we really did have everything. You have a crew of 150 filmmakers, you have 15 actors, you have that, you know, you have 300-400 people all gathered. So he can say that. By the way, we shot on actual film. So there is actual film, you know, analog, light image. One of the most incredible, I feel privileged to have been there.
Yeah. And you think about who was in that friggin' movie. I mean, you know, this is just the number of Oscars sitting around that table.
It was crazy.
Know, and then flying into space. It was just like, oh my God. So I feel like I should let you go on with your day. First, expect a visit from me next time I'm in LA. We're friends now.
Love that. We have to do dinner.
And you can call me without having to be on this show too. I'll give you my cell. You just call.
Yeah, I had a radar moment where I'm like, he's the guy to talk to about Dunbar's number. And what a pleasure.
Well, thanks. Now, I appreciate you even knowing who I am and my work. It means a lot because I've known yours for a good while now, and it's nice to know. You know, it's funny because I was going to be originally I was a theater director. I went to CalArts and AFI and did all that stuff, and then ended up not doing it because the internet happened and I was sick of theater. It was so elitist and so expensive. I'm all Brechtian and Marxist and the theater. You lost me. And because I thought the internet was going to be the people's medium. Yeah, look at that. Ha ha. But now that I'm doing, you know, I'm doing my monologues, it's like I'm doing stand up and it's like I'm back.
Love
in that
it.
It's because it is that it's the shamanic, you know, the shamanic act. But yeah, but I feel like now it's sort of I can see the way my work has informed people. Like I'll hear from the guys who did Everything Happens All at Once and they go, oh yeah, you know, your stuff was instrumental in that or this. And I'm so I'm in the conversation. It's like informing the people who are making the movies is actually a lot easier than staying out all night with a friggin' rain machine. Making movies is so hard. Oh my God.
It's fun though. It is.
Yeah.
What a pleasure. And
yes.
Any time.
Thank you. All right. And thanks. So thank you for being on Team Human. Thank you all for being on Team Human. You can support this little ship for as long as we have an ocean to navigate on by going to patreon.com/teamhuman. Become a supporter. You can come to the premieres of our YouTubes, and then I'm there on Patreon live for an hour afterwards talking to y'all and having fun. You can come to live events when we do them. Maybe we'll go to LA. We'll do a live event. And Adam will be there, and you'll friggin' love it. All right. You've been on Team Human. We're produced by Joshua Chapdelaine and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.